Thanks very much for joining us today, Stanley.
Well, I'm very glad to be online.
So I've got a couple of questions. The first one is about your book, Compromat. It's a book which is, it's a satire, isn't it? And it is a take on Brexit, and it's a take on 21st century political events which have recently taken place. Can you tell me what other aspects of it are satirical? Because you do talk about modern technology, 21st century technology being used against politicians and against people of public intrigue. So is it also a satire on the way that the modern technology is affecting politicians' lives?
Well, I'd say in the first instance it is a satire on what happened in the last 2 years, and particularly in the run-up to Brexit on the one hand, which took place, or the Brexit vote took place in June 23rd, 2016, and then there was the American presidential election, which followed that in November 2016. So basically those are the two, you know, big milestones in the book, and I looked at what happened, and bear in mind I wrote this book pretty soon after the Trump election of November 2016. As far as I remember, I started writing in about February 2017, and I finished it by the end of March, I think. So it was a quick take, and it was essentially a political satire. It dealt not just with Brexit, but of course it also dealt with Trump. I mean, those were two sides of the same coin. And for the purposes of my satire, I had Russia very much at the heart of both Brexit and Trump. Now, the irony is that in America, a whole lot of excavation has gone on, and people have uncovered all kinds of links between, you know, the Trump campaign or Trump personnel and Russia. Whereas in the UK, I would say there has not yet been this, you know, detailed examination of whether or not the Russians were involved in the EU referendum. There's been quite a lot of evidence quite recently, you may have seen some mention of it, that they were definitely involved in the UK 2017 general election, i.e. the one which took place a year after, with Mr. Corbyn's, you know, sudden surprising surge being attributed in part to, you know, Russian trolling and Russian memoranda and Russian-inspired emailing and so on and so forth. So, yes, it's particularly a satire on those two events. Is it a satire on the technology? Not so much, although there's a lot of stuff about bugging, and, you know, but it's more, I should think that's more farce than satire. I mean, the opening of the book.
And also our reliance or modern reliance on these on technology, which can be so compromising at times.
Well, yes, I mean, it begins with the president of Russia in the book. He's called Igor Popov, accidentally on purpose shooting the American presidential candidate, who's called Ronald Craig, in the backside with a hypodermic dart, which is meant to be aiming at a tiger. Well, of course, the dart, as you can imagine, carries a transmitting device and so on and so forth.
Do you think fiction is a mirror of reality, or is the current political climate contrived by the media? Is the modern media machine contriving satire in that way?
Well, on this particular case, every time I thought I was ahead of the game, reality quickly gallops up. And so, at least as far as the U.S. side of things is concerned, almost everything I had in the book now appears to have happened, if you see what I mean. And of course, we do wait to have Mr. Mueller's report, the former FBI director. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if, for example, he does find out what I suggested in the book, that the real reason why James Comey relaunched the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, which had this crippling effect on our campaign. I mean, Mueller may discover that, yes, it was because, you know, the Russians had planted some compromising material in Anthony Weiner's laptop, which then gave the excuse to the FBI to look at the whole laptop. They needed that. And don't tell me that the Russians might not have been behind that. And, of course, I had a wonderful scene in the book, I think I did anyway, where my U.S. congressman is texting this lady, or sending who he thinks is an underage schoolgirl in Illinois, when it is, of course, a rather comely Russian secret agent working out of the FSB office in St. Petersburg. Anyway, but it'd be funny. So that's why I say I'm still waiting for that shoe to drop, if you see what I mean, and to find out that the Russian was involved not just in the generality, with the Democratic Party's files and the Wikipedia stuff, and as we now know, the sort of Facebook scoping. Mm-hmm. But it would be very interesting to know if they actually also manufactured that Comey FBI. Yeah.
But would that be at all surprising, do you think? Probably not, I don't think.
Would it be what?
Surprising if it was found that they were meddling in the...
No, I don't think it's at all surprising. That's what you're meant to do if you're running an intelligence service. You know, what is it all about? It's much cheaper than having a war.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so I'll just back to your life. So you've served as an MP and you've worked for the EU.
An MEP, I should say, a member of the European Parliament.
Yes, yeah. In your eyes, how much has changed since you were active in politics and in public life?
Well, for me, I think the sea change in the Conservative Party in its attitudes to Europe has been absolutely crucial. For a long time, when I first joined as an MEP, I'd been in the European Commission before that, I would say that the Conservative Party was proud of its position as a pro-Europe party. Mr. Heath might have been a bit odd in terms of his own personality, but nonetheless, we recognised that he had taken Britain into Europe. When I joined the European Parliament in 1979, would you believe it? There were 61 pretty much pro-Europe Conservative MEPs.
Wow. Yeah.
That has changed.
Yeah. Certainly.
The Conservatives, the sceptical group of the Conservatives, have gone on. They've stayed on. It's a bit like the Bitterenders in South Africa. They have kept, and in the end, they captured the party, and they captured the party to the extent that even though there is not a majority in the House of Commons, and probably not even a majority in the Conservative Party for coming out of Europe, nonetheless. The Eurosceptics in the Tory party are so dominant that this is what's happened.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's not really a long time, is it? This is only sort of very recent, the populist movement. It's been building up for the past 30 years, I suppose, or maybe 40 years, few decades.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, in some people's eyes, that's a long time.
More or less as soon as it...
absolutely right. It has been linked with nationalism as well. You see, America First the National Party. And I think you could say that insofar as there is a single major theme among the Eurosceptic Tories, it is this notion that somehow we have lost a bit of our sovereignty by being part of the... But for me, it's perfectly obvious you're going to lose sovereignty if you join a supranational organization like the EU. You know, But the argument is you gain so much more than you lose.
Right.
But that is not where the Eurosceptics stand, and it's not where apparently the country stands, given the vote which happened. Now, from my own personal point of view, I say, okay, the country voted. I, as you know, set up an organization called Environmentalists for Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I was keen to make sure we didn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We retained all the good things.
Yeah.
We lost the vote, so my position is we've lost the vote. We're going to come out. So I'm still fighting to try and keep the good things which we did. But I absolutely recognize that we're not going to have the same situation as before, where we sit around a table and agree common rules. That's not going to happen.
All right. I think that's about all I've got time for you today, Stan.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled. Thank you so much.